Hello, it's Kathy Love here. I'm a business coach who helps allied health professionals run powerful and profitable businesses in the disability sector. It's my pleasure to share up more private practice stories and wisdom in this, our third season. My guests are generous, creative, and honest. It has been such a joy to be able to hold these conversations and capture these moments for your listening pleasure. We're sure that you'll really enjoy these unplugged chats and these private practice heart-to-hearts. So settle in, let's get the conversation started. Welcome to the podcast, Jeremy Stretton, who is a lawyer and the founding director of the Business Legal Lifecycle and an author. And at this point, I forget that it's an auditory-only medium because I'm holding up his book and all the battered pages. How are you, Jeremy?
I'm very well, thanks, Kathy. How are you?
I am good. As we said before the recording, my day has become better than expected. You know, some days you're just not sure and whatever happens is a bonus. So all good.
Excellent.
Introduce yourself. What's your background? How did you get to this sort of business ownership bit?
Yeah, so I've been a lawyer for about 15 years. So I started out of university, decided to go and work for a law firm, got a couple of offers out of university, as you do, took a job which I really enjoyed working for, worked there for 8 years. But I knew that I wanted more. And at the time, I was working with Craig Mason, who's my business partner in Stretton Mason Lawyers. And we were working together and we thought we didn't like where that law firm was going. We loved the people. We loved the bosses. And we love what we learned, but they were going for a big firm mentality. And we didn't want that. We wanted to be have our own destiny at our own hands. So we decided to start up our own law firm. And that was back in 2011, September 2011. And from there, we've built, basically from the ground up, a really good business. And we've learned a lot. We had no idea what we were doing about actually running a business.
Who knew? It'll be fun, they said. It'll be, you'll have flexibility of your time, they said.
Yeah. I think that's a delusion that we all have. And but we've found that we really enjoyed it. And we've basically, as lawyers, we started off acting for businesses. And one of the things that we came very passionate about was, rather than niching and being a property lawyer or a commercial lawyer or a presumption lawyer or anything in between, we wanted to serve as a type of client. So what we did is we said, rather than being this type of lawyer, we'll help this type of client, and that was small to medium-sized businesses.
Wow, that's really different. I was wondering how you arrived at the SME kind of place, but that's a real flip around. Way cool.
I'll just say the reason for that was because the feedback that we got from our clients was that they didn't like the big firm mentality of being you get stovepiped into one area and then you get moved around to different people depending on your different areas. So we wanted to provide a holistic service for our clients so that they knew that they were coming to us for all of their advice. And it's worked out very well over the last six and a half years.
And you also get to adventure with them right through the whole startup, struggle, sustain, sell trajectory as well. And there are so many legal bits and pieces that fall in and out of that whole life cycle. So I guess you've been mapping the legal life cycle for years and also just hanging on to your own adventure as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And so the legal life cycle, the business legal life cycle came about essentially as lawyers, we were trying to figure out a way of how can we provide more value for our clients? Because a lot of people don't like
coming. Now, they're words you don't hear often.
That's right. Well, people don't like coming to see lawyers. I don't know why. And so our work was very reactionary. It was always when people have a problem, they come to see us. And that's not a very good business model for us. And it also doesn't help us build lifelong relationships with our clients, which is what we want. So that's where the business legal life cycle came in. So as you mentioned before, I've written a book called The Business Legal Life Cycle. And essentially what it is 13 phases of when you should do things in a legal point of view, from a legal point of view, I should say, in your business, and a realistic time frame, rather than just doing everything at the beginning, actually map it out so that you've got some structure as to when you should take steps in business.
It's brilliant. I loved it. As soon as I got it, I read it. And I think I've said to you before, I would have loved this book 15 years ago because you don't know what you don't know. And sometimes you just get paralyzed by anxiety, so you don't do anything. So rather than doing everything wrong at the start, people just don't do enough or don't do the right sort of things. So I just love it. And I think fair to say it's written in plain English and it's not jargonistic. It gives you the words as you need them and describes them, but it really steps you through the, now you do this, but next you've got to be thinking about this.
That's right. And that's one of the goals. So the three main reasons that we came up with the Business Legal Lifecycle were to help explain things in plain English. And I always say that I fight my inner lawyer and actually do that and actually explain them in plain English because so many lawyers don't do it. We like to, the book explains why you do things from a legal point of view in your business. So often lawyers just say, just do this, but you have no idea why you're doing those things. So we explain that. And we also want to help our business owners develop a plan for the future. So to have something that they can actually do going forward in their business.
Yeah. The guys that I have the privilege of working with, they might be thinking about starting up or they might have started up but perhaps not optimally, or they might be in a fast growth phase and they're just hanging on for dear life. If we go back to the guys that are in the first 5 years of business, what are the mistakes that you see time after time that people make?
I think probably the first one is not getting advice from all of your consultants. So lawyers advise on legal advice, accountants advise for taxation reasons, and other consultants advise for other reasons. Yeah, I could list off 10 or 20 consultants, but the problem is that you go and get advice from one consultant, but you don't go and get advice from all of your consultants and make sure that they talk and make sure that there's a holistic advice. And that's one of the things that I'm very big with my, especially accounting partners and other consultants, is that we actually talk to each other. And there might be a great reason from an accounting point of view to have a structure that's set up and the client just have one structure for, say, multiple businesses or different investments or things like that. But from a legal point of view, that's a disaster, because if something goes wrong with one of those entities,
The lot goes.
That's right. And so I think that there's a big problem in the fact that people don't get all their consultants in the same room and talk it out.
I agree.
And I think probably the other problem is that often a consultant is afraid to be seen to not know what they're talking about. And so often I get consultants who, to use the example I said before, where I've got a client who has a business operated from my company and trust. That same company and trust owns properties, it owns shares, and it's a high-risk business. So their accountant didn't really understand the separate legal entities and the fact that they needed to have a separate entity for each investment to properly protect them. And the accountant had admitted to me that, yeah, he didn't know that, but he was afraid to actually go and ask for advice, because he wanted to seem like he knew everything and wasn't an idiot in front of the client.
Takes a tribe to raise a business.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And sometimes when you're in your early days and you've got your L plates on, it can be quite a big moment to sort of challenge an accountant or to challenge a lawyer or to ask a question again or for more explanation. And I remember in the early days, I would give my accountant the whiteboard marker and I would just make him stand there and draw it, poor bloke, until I understood it. And so being visual, once I had a map of how it all hung together, I was fine. Absolutely fine and good to go. So sometimes you have to accommodate your own expectations and your own anxiety and manage other people, and the value of getting them all in the room or in the virtual room, I can see, is absolute gold. Absolute gold.
Absolutely. And as you explained, everyone's got a different way of learning and understanding things, and people need to recognize that. And so often consultants don't, because they know it and they just want you to do what they're telling you to do it, but it often doesn't work that way.
Yeah. Any other problems that you see people repeating time after time?
I think that probably the next one would be when you're actually engaging with clients. So that's phase three is initial clients. Is not putting proper procedures in place to properly engage with those clients. So having a standard terms and conditions or a standard contract that you engage with your clients in, so often when we start business, we're so eager to get in there and start doing the work, we don't want to even think about that because we just want to start working
for the
clients.
People might say no and not want to work with us.
Yes. And if they say that, then be worried. There's a reason that they don't want to work with you and they don't want to sign a document. And what I find is that, especially when you start out, and you don't have an agreement in place, and then you go through the business and say it could be 3, 4, 5 years down the track, you could still be working with that client with no agreement in place, and then there's a problem. They've refused to pay. They refuse to do something with you, and then you're left without any written agreement because it was okay. It was my first person. I shouldn't have had any problems with them. So properly engaging with your clients and customers is really important, and then having a standard like debt collection process. So if you're getting paid up front, and I would always recommend if people can to get paid up front before they provide a service or product, but that's not always possible. But if you provide any work on credit, then you need to have some sort of debt recovery process in place to make sure that people follow that and that your staff follow that to make sure, or that you follow that to make sure that you get paid on a regular basis. Because otherwise, you can end up with a very large debtor's ledger that you can never get down.
Yep, and that gets overwhelming and self-defeating. And it's unfortunate to have to write that stuff off when you've provided the work. The allied health and disability sector, we tend to call that document a service agreement. Yep. And some people I speak to have been providing and working with a service agreement for years and years and years, and others have never heard of it. And it's really interesting to think about how people find out about this. Mm. Because it is kind of business 101 in a way, but you can sort of go years down the track of business and still not have anything, or have tried it and it didn't work, or people said no, so you just parked it. But it is kind of the formalizing of your business relationship, isn't it?
Absolutely. And if they're not willing to sign it, or if they try and change things, you've got to be concerned as to why they're doing that. And I always think that you just need to have those processes in place early on, because then you find that it'll consistently happen in your business. So, and as I say, you don't know what as you said before, you don't know what you don't know. No. And if you never have a problem, you'll never see the benefit in it. But it's the 1% of cases where you do have the problem.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. I don't know if I've spoken with you at length about the National Disability Insurance Scheme. I'll buy you a beer and bring you up to speed on this one. Well, as an Australian, you probably know about this big new funding scheme coming in, and they're very much a catalyst for bringing private practitioners into something resembling mainstream commercial business thinking. And, the service agreement term has been tossed around in social media groups and is being asked about, but it's quite a cause of anxiety, because is there a standard template, and what should be in it and what should be out of it? And it's really good to see, in a way, that private practitioners are starting to adopt these documents and see the benefit of it. Although they might be whinging a wee bit that it's somewhat cumbersome and it's always needing updating, it's actually, a good thing to see, I think, on the whole.
I agree. I think sometimes government do things that actually benefit people, and that would be a case when they do. Yeah,
may not think so too much at the moment. All righty. So there's some typical errors that you guys witness, and it's about getting advice and getting advice around the table and questioning and confirming, and then also having a formal agreement in place with your clients or consumers. Is there anything else, or are they the biggies?
They're probably the two biggest ones. If you're bringing on employees, that's another big area where you've got to document everything properly early on. Make sure that you've got employment contracts. Make sure you understand who you're employing. I don't know how many of your listeners actually will employ staff, but understanding the difference between an employee and a contractor and making sure that they're properly engaged is really key. Do you want me to go through that a bit?
Oh, I would just love a dollar for every time I've been asked. And it's just the very best question to ask. I'm just so pleased when people do ask, because it means that they're curious and wanting to get it right. I have probably heard and read every possible variation on this conversation. If we ask the question of HR advisors, they may have a slightly different view to the legal world, and that's really interesting. You go on the ATO website, that's different to Fair Work Australia. So it's one of those X-Files moments where the truth is out there, and I really encourage all of my clients and people I talk to is to get advice from both legal and HR and to just keep asking until they understand it, because I don't want anyone to be hit with the $64,000 fine when it is avoidable.
That's right.
Okay, and I think, rant over. Just bring us up to date.
Well, I guess the point I was going to make was the fact that it does change. So, as you say, there's advice on the ATO website. There's advice that you'll get from Fair Work. There's advice that you'll get from all manner of different people. And you've really got to look at the actual circumstances, and also often the same circumstances where someone might be an employee. There might be one slight little difference that makes them a contractor. And so you've got to really get advice. If you think there's any gray area, then you really should get some advice. As a default position, if they're an employee, then you're usually fine because the employee's got all the entitlements. So if you choose to make an employee, then you probably don't need to worry about it so much. But if you're going to go down the contractor route, there are so many different factors about what the hours that they're working, what direction they're taking from you, their tools of trade that they use, the location, who pays them, that all go into a big melting pot. And at the end of the day, someone, whether it be Fair Work, the ATO, a judge, has to decide what classification that person actually is. So make sure that you get advice, especially if you're going for a contractor, because there is no one silver bullet answer. You need to get everyone's advice and basically work towards that. And if you get someone's advice and they say they're a contractor and they're found not to be a contractor, well, you know, then you can potentially go after that person. But get the advice and you'll usually be fine.
Yeah. Where I get incredibly distressed and legally anxious is when I hear that something along the lines of, my friend has contractors, so I just used their contract.
Yeah. I call that barbecue advice.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that's kind of cool. Yeah, that works.
Yeah, I call that barbecue advice. And I don't mean that in an insulting way. I mean that in a well-meaning friends and family have good advice from their experience where they've gone and got advice from their consultants that was right for them potentially.
Yeah.
That advice doesn't necessarily go the same way. I advise clients on this all the time where they've been told by a friend or family and who have no bad intentions. They want to do the best thing for that person.
Save them some money, save them some time. All the motivators are good.
Absolutely. There's nothing untoward going on at all, but they just, unless you understand someone's whole complete position, then you can't give the proper advice and you don't know what you don't know. As I love to say, and I love the fact that you said that before. And it's, you don't know what you don't know and your advisors don't know what they don't know and your friends and family don't know what they don't know. So you need to make sure that the advice you're getting is from people who understand your complete picture and make sure that everything is right moving forward.
Best investment ever is to get that legal advice and to get that contract drawn up properly.
Absolutely.
And to potentially get ongoing HR and legal advice as well, just to accommodate the changes. And I just think it's a really great self-investment for business owners that they are building their fluency and their confidence with the legalese and the HR aspects. Because I kind of get the sense that building team is one of the biggest barriers to growth in small business because it's perceived to be expensive and it's perceived to be anxiety provoking and such a commitment. And it's a shame. It's a shame. I just think so much more value can be served to the community if there is an easier and more supportive pathway for small business owners to bring in more clinicians and admin support.
Yeah, absolutely. And bringing those people in the right way will prevent all those problems and those horror stories that you hear. So get the advice, do it right, and then you'll avoid those pitfalls that so many people fall into.
Yep. Cool. Let's jump between the pages of this mighty fine book because I'm still waving it around, not that anyone can see that. They can just hear the pages fly past the microphone. I loved it. I've read a bit about business life cycles, but I haven't read anything this thorough. And what your life cycle has is all of the steps, not just the big ones that people can identify with. It's got all the transitional phases, if you like, and that's what attracted my thinking on it. I'm sure you know all of those phases inside out. Would you like to run through? If you miss one, I'll let you know. I've got the index here. You want to kind of just give a bit of a high-level view of what the typical business life cycle looks like?
Yeah, sure. And I'll definitely do that. And what I'll do is I'll break it up into the four parts. So the business legal life cycle is 13 phases for anyone who hasn't seen it. And we also break that up into four parts. And that's startup part. That's the first three phases. You got your consolidation, which is the next three, scaling, which is the next four, and business exit, which is the last three. So essentially, the business legal life cycle, there's many ways to be right, and I'm not saying that you have to go through every phase in sequential order. Some things happen earlier, but I'll go through it. But just to be clear to the listeners, that we're not saying that you have to do things in this particular order,
because
sometimes things come up earlier, and I'll try and explain that as I go through it. How's that sound?
Right. Yep, I've got my water bottle. I'm good to go.
Excellent.
Phase one.
All right. So phase one is conception. So this is the phase where you have the idea for the business, and this is before you set up any entities, engage with any clients, and it's about setting your goals properly and setting up your starting to talk to a team of advisors to make sure that you get the right structure in place to get the right advice moving forward. So it's probably a very quick phase. It's probably something that people probably go through in their head more than anything else. In the book, I want to explain to people that you need to sit down and think about these things. You need to think about who your team are. You need to think about your goals. You know, you need to think about all that stuff so that you actually know where you're going. Because I'm sure you've been through this before, but if you don't know where you're going, how are you ever going to get there? So,
and sometimes it can be really hard to package up your imagination and drill down into your ideal client. Mm. And I do some work with startups. I love working with startups because I just love harnessing that energy. But it's really interesting to work with startups to define what they're not going to do.
Yes. Yeah, you got to avoid the temptation of being all things to all people,
exactly, as
we both know. So you've got to be able to provide that advice and work out what you actually enjoy doing. So that's what the phase one conception is. It's all about trying to figure out those parts. It's probably the least legal of all the phases, but it's something that I thought was pretty important to have in there to make sure people understood what was going on in at the beginning of their business. Mm. The second one is phase two startup. So this is where you go, okay, I've had my idea, I'm going to actually start this thing. And so here we're talking about what structure do you use to set up your business? So is it a company? Do you set up a trust? Are you a sole trader? All these different options. So going through all those options. Do you need to lease premises? So things like that. So do you need to actually have a physical premises for your business, or do you go out and see people, or do they come to your home? Setting up the lease properly. Mm-hmm. Thinking about those kind of things is very important early on. And what I'm very big on is there's other things, and we'll go through in later phases, that a lot of lawyers will say, do this now, like get a trademark. Well, my view on that is don't worry about a trademark now. Wait till you've actually got a viable business. Worry about protecting your intellectual property. Don't spend thousands of dollars now. Wait till until you've actually got something that's worthwhile protecting.
Okay. I have thoughts on that. Okay. Continue.
It depends on the type of business, of course, but phase three is initial clients. So this is when you've started up your business and you need to go and get some clients. And as I talked about before, probably the key one here is having an engagement process with the clients. How are they going to sign up? How are they going to engage with your business? Are they going to sign a service agreement? If you're billing them and they're paying you later, what kind of tax invoice have you got? What kind of pro forma tax invoice and what kind of collection process, as I said before, do you have in place? Putting those things in place early on is very important, as I said earlier, to make sure you get that momentum with your clients. So those first three are the startup phases. So they're all about, as you're just starting up the business, and they usually happen pretty quickly, to be fair, because once you've got your idea, we all get excited by our ideas and we jump in there and we want to start doing it. So, they generally happen pretty quickly. So that's the startup part of the business legal life cycle. Phase four is bringing on employees. So this is, as I said before, if you choose to bring on employees or staff, then this is the time to do it. So this is after you've started your business, got some clients, worked out that you worked out your business model, almost got your minimum viable product going, if you want to use that kind of terminology, worked out that you've actually got something that's worthwhile scaling to some extent and bringing on some employees to help you out. So here we're talking about having the right employment contracts in place, doing employee policies, making sure that you understand your workplace health and safety requirements, having all that in place so that you can properly bring on your employees. So this is the beginning of the consolidation phase, and I call it that because in the image of the business legal lifecycle, there's actually a dip and it's very deliberate, because what we want to acknowledge is the fact that in business, sometimes things go wrong. There's nothing we can do to stop that, but we can be prepared for it. And more often than not, those dips have something to do with employees, and that's fine. That's very normal. That might be that you're spending more time training your employee. So there'll be some sort of dip. So we actually put that as a dip just to acknowledge that fact does occur, and that you might get a dip in your business, but don't worry about it. There's plenty of other things to do it, and everyone else has been there before. Yeah.
So to illustrate that dip a bit, I loved reading about that. I thought that was great. I hadn't seen it as nicely described. It's that tension about when you bring in admin or when you bring in that first clinician or therapist in my world, and that you're releasing some of the clinical work, and there's this perception that there's a loss of income. But it's actually, I describe it as a bit of a calibration, that there is a phase when you've got to train people up, you're coming off the tools, but that can be really hard for the amazing technicians that have started the business and are so comfortable with the face-to-face client-facing work. And so rarely is it permanent in my experience. And what I often have to convince some of the people I talk to is that it frees them up for different valued work and product development and strengthening partnerships. Mm. So it often needs a fair bit of justification, because they don't engage team because they know there will be a dip and that they'll lose income. But in fact, when you know it's going to happen, you manage through it, and it's the best thing ever.
That's exactly right. So that's why I wanted to acknowledge it in the life cycle,
very cool.
Actually. Call it out and say, this is what happens, and know what's going to happen and just be
work prepared. For it. Yep.
Yep. So phase five is protecting intellectual property. So this is where, if you choose to do so, you can register a trademark for your business. Again, I don't know that there's a lot of businesses that actually need the protection of a trademark, because I don't know, a lot of small to medium-sized businesses don't really need that level of protection. If you're going to look at expanding and having franchises or licenses or a massive brand, then you need to think about actually registering a trademark. But it seems to me to be a large expense that's not really worth a lot, because even if you don't register your trademark, you still have protection from someone else stealing it, and what the legal term is passing it off as being your part of your brand. So it is in phase five. A lot of people and a lot of my clients do protect their intellectual property by getting a registered trademark, but I don't think it's 100% necessary. And one of the reasons that I put it where I put it in the life cycle is one, to make sure you've got that minimum viable business, but also, how many times do we see clients who change their name along the line?
Yep.
And once you've registered that trademark, you can't go and change it. You've got to go back and start with a whole new application process. Mm-hmm. I had a client who started a mortgage software business, and he named it something, and he paid me quite a lot of money. He's a good friend of mine.
Good
paid
on
me
him.
Quite a good
yep.
money to register a trademark. Sorry, pardon?
They're the mates you want.
That's right. good mate of mine. He registered a trademark, and then right at the 11th hour, just before we were about to finalize the registration, he said, "Oh, I've changed the name." And he spent all this money reapplying for another one. Now, that taught me a very good lesson, in the sense that I should never have let him go and do it before he had his minimum viable product. And so that's one of the reasons, and I see that time and time again. So he was very insistent. He's an ex-lawyer as well. He was very insistent upon registering it, and he came to regret it quite a bit now, just from the hard cost. So doing that at that stage is really, you'll know that you've actually got a business that's worthwhile protecting. But make sure that if you do want to register a trademark, that you get some pretty good commercial advice from your lawyer as to whether or not it's worthwhile protecting.
Yep.
Also,
yep.
Protecting intellectual property, I talk about putting together your systems and processes for your business. So in a business, the real value in your business is your intellectual property. And that's how you do your work, who your clients and customers are. Phase five is all about building that to be the right asset for you to go forward in your business. And you'll understand when I go through the other phases, and Kathy, you've already read my book, so you'll understand this already, but the other phase is why it's so important to have that intellectual property protected at that point in time.
So you're saying here that the intellectual property in a business is the way that you do things.
Yeah. It's your systems and processes.
Yeah.
And a lot of people miss that. And I think it's very important, because at the end of the day, and we'll get to business exit in a minute, everyone will exit their business at some time in their life. And so whether or not you do that voluntarily, or whether something happens, or you just shut down the business, you know, if you want to sell it for any sort of money, someone is buying your intellectual property. So that's who your clients are, how you engage with them, how you do the work in your business, how do you perform your services. So if you haven't got those documented properly, then that really devalues your business later on when you do have to sell.
Yeah. I get the sense that intellectual property in the allied health world is the technical therapeutic techniques and the resources they develop around the actual service and use of hands and mind with the client. And that's a great reminder, thank you, Jeremy, that your intellectual property is actually the way you run your business as well, and the documents you might have in place and the report templates and the flow charts and how things are done. And I liken it at times, a bit gruesomely, I might say, to the hit by a bus scenario. So if you as the business owner couldn't go into work tomorrow, what document does the business open so that they can keep the wheels of industry running without you? Because essentially as a business owner, you've designed all of those systems to be able to hum along without you anyway. And rarely do people appreciate that is a form of intellectual property. The emphasis in our allied health world is that it's all the clinical stuff, as we call it.
Yes. And that's very normal. I should say, I think that probably 95% of businesses that I know of don't have that intellectual property protected. And they're exposing themselves from that. Yes, it's a gruesome thought, but yeah, if you did get hit by a bus and everything's up here in your head, then you're going to forget that.
Yeah, it's no good to anyone. You really don't want anyone to be able to read your mind as a rule.
No, that wouldn't be a good thing.
Alrighty, so IP is broader than most people think. It's your systems and policies and procedures, and it's also your clinical know-how, and all the whole lot needs to be captured in a document somewhere.
Yep, absolutely. So having that put together is really important. That's why we put it in phase five. And the other reason that we put it in phase five is also because if you have chosen to bring on employees or staff or contractors, then you really need to think about getting them to help you actually put that together, because they'll be working in the business. And one of the, probably of that 5% of people that I know that do actually have systems in place, probably 5% of those actually get their employees to help them write it, so that make sure that it's practical and useful, because there's no point in having a system in place if you're not going to use it.
Yeah, and to literally build it from the ground up. And there's always going to be parts of your business that you just don't really quite know how they work. So you may as well get someone else who lives that day in, day out to write that stuff up. Ah, very cool. Alrighty, next phase.
Next phase is phase six, which is maximizing your business and bringing in investors. So here, this is actually at the bottom of the dip and the last phase of the consolidation part of the business legal life cycle. So this is, you've basically got everything in place. You've got some employees, you've started your business, you've got clients, you've protected your intellectual property as you see fit. And now it's time to maximize what you actually have in your business and maximize the people that you have. Now, maximizing your business is a very loose term. There's no one definition, and it's different for every single business owner. It does not mean everyone in your business working from 7 a.m. till 7 p.m. without lunch breaks, doing all the work. It's what actually works is the most efficient in your business, so that you can make sure that everything's humming along nicely. And it's the time when you get to see everything that's going on in your business and making sure that it is humming along smoothly, and making sure that there's no problems. Because the next part is all about scaling. And when you scale, if you've got problems in your business, they'll multiply as you go through that. So you need to make sure at this point in time that you're consolidating. You can also choose at this point to bring in investors. So if you choose to bring in an investor that you know, will help you scale in the future, this is the time to do it. I'm not sure that your clients in the allied health space would probably do that very much. There's not a lot of people that do. I can see you shaking your head. Yeah, so I would say that, you know, yes, it's there, but yeah, unless you're looking at building a massively scaled business, it's not worth worrying about the bringing in investors, but maximizing your business and making sure that you're humming along nicely is really what phase six is all about.
Yeah. I would say that at this point, there's also a reasonable amount of fatigue happening, just mental fatigue and business fatigue. And there could be anxiety that you're not good enough, or you're not across your numbers enough, or that there's team problems. And often at this time, this is often when I get my clients coming in, and we do some work about values and defining what success is for you.
Mm.
As well, because often I sometimes hear, well, I want to grow, and then we talk about, well, what is it that you want it to look like, and what is it that you've got to grow? So there's often in this dip. The good news is for the listeners that we'll provide the link and you can check all of this out and sort of get the playbook and sing along with us. But there's often, this is, I don't know about you, but I find this to be quite a reflective period as well.
Mm, absolutely. It certainly is. It's a time when you need to, I think, reassessing your business goals is very important at this time, because you people change their ideas. My next book that's with publishers at the moment is called Startup with an End in Mind, and that's all about setting a goal and having some sort of end in mind. And that's acknowledging the fact that, yeah, Stephen Covey, very intelligent man.
I was just about to say, I think we need to acknowledge Stephen Covey on this.
Yeah, absolutely. His was Startup with the End in Mind.
Yeah.
And I've adapted that slightly to Startup with an End in Mind.
Yeah.
Because
choose your own
adventure. It's all well and good to say, this is where I'm going. But if you don't, so many people don't know where they're going, and they also change that goal very often. I know I did. I had dreams of just running a small boutique law firm, and now, as this has developed, it's become something that we want to expand internationally with the business legal lifecycle. So you change your goals, but it's about having a goal and then moving forward to it.
Yeah.
And so also in phase six, it's probably time, as part of that goal discussion, to reassess your business structure as well. So this is a time when you depending on how you start up your business, you may want to change it if you're going to do any sort of scaling. This is a time to have a think about that, as you say, reflection. Think about where those goals, where you're going. Has that changed? And if that has changed, well, let's reassess your business structure. And right now, I mean, we're doing this in 2018, but the laws do allow you to change at certain times your business structure for small businesses without any tax consequences. So you can do that reasonably well.
Yeah. Yep. I think it would also be good to quickly chat at this point about the differences between scale and growth.
Mm.
The risk of being here and chilling the Chardonnay at 9 o'clock at night. Because I think we use those words interchangeably, and we've both heard people speak about growth being more of everything, more clients and more expenses, but scale is kind of this little secret sauce where you have more financial growth and income, but not necessarily more expenses as well. Is that your understanding of it, or was I just listening from La La Land?
No, that's definitely my understanding. And I think when I developed this concept, I probably didn't make the distinction between growth and scaling as well as I did, because the next phase, phase seven, is about expansion, franchising and licensing. And we do call that scaling, but it could also be growth as well, because you don't have to scale. So scaling is all about how to make more money without spending more money, while growth is what most businesses are going to have to do, which is spend a little bit more to make a little bit more and to invest a little bit more in your business to actually grow your business going forward.
Yeah.
So I think it's a very good distinction that you make there.
Yeah, and this is learning that I've only really wrapped my head around in the last year or two. I've been using those words interchangeably as well, but when you know the difference, it's a very different mindset and a way of doing things. So all righty, continue. Where does the business adventure go from here?
Well, so after phase six, as I said before, the next section we call scaling. It potentially could be called scaling and growth, or scaling or growth, or scaling and growth. but it starts with phase seven, which is expansion, franchising and licensing. Now, I'll say at this point, if you don't want to expand your business, then don't. there's many ways to be right, and you do not have to do it just for the sake of doing it. So more than happy for people to skip over phase seven, but this is if you do choose to expand, then this is making sure that you have everything in place properly and that you're thinking about all of the different things that you need to think about when you're expanding. As I said earlier, if you have problems in your business and you don't solve them by phase seven and you expand, those problems will multiply, sometimes exponentially.
Yeah.
And so it's a matter of thinking about those things properly. So you know, if you're thinking about expanding and having another premises, you're going to need a whole nother lease for your premises. You're going to need a whole other staff for that premises potentially, unless you've got visited offices, which some people do have. But you've got all these things that just expand that you need to make sure that you're basically going back and looking at it and then making sure that it's all set up correctly for you now and making sure it's all set up properly and consistently for your business going forward. I won't talk much about franchising because I think that your clients and listeners probably don't do much franchising, but if you did want to look at franchising, it's a very cumbersome process, very rewarding as well, because you've got to have all your systems and processes in place to be able to franchise. So that goes back to phase five and having all your systems, having a manual. If you think about the McDonald's franchise, the manual is, you know, I'm using my hands as well to demonstrate it, but it's many, many, many reams of paper thick. That's because they've got a proven system. So I won't bore the listeners too much with that, but that if you do want to think about franchising, then make sure you read up about it and make sure that you get everything done right on that in that part.
Yep. And to say that policy and procedure manual doesn't happen overnight, we wrote ours year after year after year and then checked. And when I sold the business, I don't know, I might have said this on a podcast before, when I sold the business, I had, as part of the due diligence, I had to print it out. And our little private practice didn't fit. It was hundreds and hundreds of papers, of pages, and it didn't fit in an Archlever folder. We needed two. And I cannot tell you how proud I was. So proud. So yeah. Proud. And to actually see the whole business printed out was really interesting. So, restaurants, interestingly enough, some of the big chain restaurants do that policy and procedure manual brilliantly.
Well, and that's because in that industry there, it's such a big focus. So, and just going back to what you said about the fact that you built that policies and procedures manual, that's the way that it has to be. If you just have a policies and procedures manual that you write in 2017, you sell your business in 2027, it won't be applicable. Business changes, processes change, the way that you do things changes. It needs to be a living, breathing document that has changed time and time again. It's like we as a law firm, we really struggle to get it because the laws change all the time. The way to do things changes all the time. So you're constantly updating the systems and procedures, which is rewarding in itself for our staff because they're on top of it. But it's still a big challenge. But it's at the end of the day, it's worth the value that you're gonna get at the end.
Yep. It was. I liken it to a recipe book.
Yes.
That you can pull it off the shelf and follow the instructions and reproduce.
Yep.
The thing.
Don't leave it on the shelf.
Yeah,
make sure that you use it.
Yep. All righty, what's next?
Right. Next one is phase eight, which is estate planning. And so this is one of the ones where you could do it earlier, but most people don't because most people don't like to think what's going to happen when they pass away or when they get injured. So estate planning is putting a plan in place to make sure that when something does happen to you, that your loved ones or your business partners aren't left with nothing and trying to deal with the law. That can sometimes be unfair or confusing at the time. A lot of people think that if you're a husband and wife and the husband passes away, the wife will just get anything. That might be true, but if you've got kids, then they can actually get a portion of it as well. So estate planning is very important. And what I say in the book and what I say to our clients is if you haven't done estate planning earlier, I understand why you don't want to do it, but now's the time to do it. You've got this great business, whether or not you've been through the expansion phase or not, or whether you want to expand. If you've maximized your business, you've got something that's worthwhile protecting. So protect it. Spend the money at this point in time and make sure that you can actually build forth a structure that will protect your family going forward because there's nothing worse. And I unfortunately have seen this time and time again where a loved one has died, their affairs have been an absolute mess. So the family's not only dealing with their grief, they're also dealing with
logistics,
trying to put the mess back together again. It's really sad and it's not that hard to do a will and it's worth every single cent in my view.
Yeah. And I, well, from experience, the discussion with the lawyer is another one of those I didn't know that was a thing moments. And the questions that the lawyer is asking you are really, really interesting and important. And you may not come up with the answers immediately, but to have questions put to you that you have just never even thought of as being relevant,
Yeah, it's confronting, and a lot of people don't they come and have the meeting, and then they don't want to deal with it anymore because it's a confronting experience. And so, I think your listeners will be able to relate to this: that being a lawyer is a lot like being a counselor, especially in this phase. People are distressed; they don't want to be thinking about these problems. And you know, our job is to help counsel people and show them why they need these things and to basically put it in place. Because once it's done, it's something that you should only think about every 2 or 3 years or if your circumstances change. But it's really important to do. And if you haven't done it before, that's why that's part of phase eight. And I'll also say just on phase eight that if you've got business partners, really important that you have some sort of agreement in case something happens to one of you, because I don't know many business partners who want to be in business with the other person's family if something happens to them.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Yep. A big discussion, but a necessary one.
Absolutely. So that's phase eight. Phase nine is investing in property. This could equally be called just investing generally. Investing in property because property is something that lawyers get involved in. It could equally be investing in shares. It could be investing in Bitcoin if that was your thing. Not that I recommend that
at all. The moment. My gosh.
You know, but my point is it could be investing in anything that you choose. And so investing, basically this is a time, and again, you could do this earlier, but this is a time where you need to start putting something aside to actually save for the future. If you can do it earlier, great. But so many people are so in their business and they're so spending their time and their money reinvesting in their business that they don't think about, well, what happens if the business falls? Where am I going to get paid otherwise? So this is the time you've protected your estate. You've got a good humming business. Now let's look at actually investing that money in something that will return something to you so that you can actually build for the future. So and in the book, I go through the buying property cycle, what to do in buying property, selling property. But that's deliberately because that's where lawyers get really involved. And it's something that I'm quite passionate about helping people to be able to do.
Yeah, absolutely. I can tell a funny, irreverent story at this point, and it implicates my daughter, so goodness knows if she's listening. A couple of nights ago, we went to see a hilarious play written by an Australian comedian, and it was about getting into the property market. It's called Vivid White. And the funniest line in the whole play for me was about someone going to an auction and collapsing on the ground, and when they're questioned, they say, I have no access to intergenerational wealth. And my daughter nudges me and says, Mum, what's intergenerational wealth? And I said, we'll talk about that in the car going home. And it was sort of and we sort of talked about it. And she said, oh, God, she said, what's my chance? And I said, oh, patchy. You know. But it's something that can consume some people as business owners and completely pass others by. And, it's part of your money conversation, I guess, whether it's with your accountant or whether with your lawyer or if you've got a financial planner who just completely rocks it for you as a family. And I think this is where family and business really come together. Mm. On the back of the will and having those structures in place, it's the what next question, I reckon.
Yep. Yeah. So that's really important to get that going at some point. As I say, there are many ways to be right, so you can do that earlier. So that's phase nine. Phase 10 is litigation and dispute resolution. Now, we debated...
Big one till last.
About where to put that in, and we decided to put it in as the second last phase before sale, which is phase 11. And the reason that we did that is because to acknowledge the fact that at some point in business, you're probably going to have some sort of litigation. It doesn't matter how good your business is. Even the best businesses in the world have been sued or have had to sue people for doing the wrong thing. So what we found is that a lot of our most successful businesses that we went through, that didn't happen until they had everything else in place, and then people started to see some value in actually going after them or doing something wrong with them that they had to go and protect with litigation. So litigation is not something that is fun. The only people who win in litigation are the lawyers. Honestly, I've been an honest lawyer. I know that's strange, but litigation is it's a costly process. A dispute resolution is the effort to try and resolve a dispute before it goes to litigation. The problem with litigation is that you go before a judge who's never seen you before. They listen to your side, they listen to the other side's side, and they are trained to understand that the answer is somewhere in the middle. So that means you'll never get what you completely want on either side. And so you'll always be disappointed in some way with what the judge decides. Dispute resolution, if you have to go down there, gives you the opportunity to sit down and talk to the other party. It gives you the opportunity to come to a resolution that you can live with without leaving in the hands of a third-party judge, which I can tell your listeners is a very risky proposition to take.
Yeah, something to avoid.
Yeah. So that's the end of the scaling phases. And the last three are the business exit phases. And the first one of those is phase 11, which is sale of whole or part of the business or listing on the stock exchange. This is where, and this is the high point of the business legal life cycle. And the reason for that is that we want your business to be at its highest point when you sell. So that will maximize your return. And that may not be the highest point the business can ever get to, but it's the highest point that you can ever get the business to, so that you make sure that you maximize your return from that business. So I say sale of the whole or part because you may have a business that has different aspects, different premises, different people in the business, and you may decide to sell part of it. The classic example is a real estate agent. Real estate agents have a rent roll and they have a sales part of their business. They sell the rent rolls all the time. That's a highly traded commodity, and so they can sell part of their business. And then the listing on the stock exchange, very few businesses actually ever do that. But if anyone's interested, that's the time to do it. It's when your business is really at its peak, and that's when you get into that. So sale of the business is really important to get right. I often say that a business, when they come to us wanting to sell, is 1 to 2 years away from actually being ready to sell. And one of the reasons that we put the business legal life cycle together was to help put the legal chocks in place to bring that 1 to 2 years down. If you have everything else in place that we've put in place as part of the first 10 phases, you'll find that 1 to 2 years is greatly reduced because you don't need to worry about so much in that. Another point to raise here that I raise in the book is, and I don't know whether any of your listeners take any money as fees, as fees, but just be warned that if you do take cash as fees and you do want to sell the business, that can be one of the biggest drains on your business. So if you, or your business value when you go to sell. So if you get paid $100 cash, you might save your tax on that if you don't declare it, so you might save, say, 30 cents in the dollar. So you've saved $30. Mm. When you go to sell the business, the business value is worked out as a multiple of your profit. So if out of that $100, you're going to have a profit of $50 and you've saved $30, but you've lost $50 profit from your books, when they go to calculate what the sale price is, say it's a 3 or 4 times multiple, you can be down $150 to $200 for each bit of cash that you take. Yeah. So I always explain that to people because most people don't realize that, and it's really confronting for businesses. And I know lots of them who do take cash as fees that they end up needing a lot more time to actually get ready for sale because the value of the business can't get up to what it should be because they've never declared that income.
Yep, absolutely. It's that short term gain.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah.
So the second last phase is phase 12 retirement, and I included this. You don't have to go straight from phase 11 to phase 12. You could choose to go back and start another business like so many people have done.
Don't know those people.
So retirement, obviously this is where it ties in very closely with estate planning to make sure that you have and investing in property actually, to make sure that you've got everything in place properly so that you can retire and you have the money to continue to live the life to which you have become accustomed or that you intend to become accustomed to. And the last phase is phase 13, which is insolvency and winding up. So this doesn't necessarily have to be a bad thing. Insolvency and winding up basically mean that your company or your entity is coming to an end. That might be because you've because you've sold your business and you just want to wind it up and get rid of it. There's nothing wrong with that. It could also be a bad thing if you haven't paid your debts, you haven't properly engaged with your clients and you can't pay your debtors. You might go straight from phase three, initial clients, straight through to insolvency winding up. And we want to avoid that, but we've got to acknowledge the fact that it's there because what we often call the death of a business at some point. And even at that point, there's nothing wrong with, from a business owner point of view, going back to phase one and starting all over again with a new business. A lot of people do that.
Oh, loads and loads and loads. But once again, it's a really critical point to get advice on and to get round the table advice as well, because what you don't want to be doing is trading as insolvent and just digging a deeper, deeper hole from which it's incredibly complicated and costly to climb out of. Yeah,
absolutely. There's probably a whole podcast just on insolvent trading there. I don't think your listeners would find it very interesting.
I think some of them probably do need to hear it, because it's another one of those you don't know what you don't know things. Mm. So gosh, well, there's something to look forward to. I'm not strong enough to tackle that topic right now, though.
Well, so that's the 13 phases in a broad brush. I hope that everyone's got a bit of value out of that, because I'm quite passionate about it, and I do know it off by heart, so I did go through it quite well.
I didn't doubt for a moment that you'd miss a phase or miss a section. I think it's great, and I love it that it's visual, and I love it that it's practical, and I love that the information is all in one place. Typically, prior to this book, I would have found all of this information in probably 40 or 50 different blogs across different websites. So it's the first time I've seen the whole lot come together. So high five to you for that one. It's cool.
Thanks very much. Cool. It's part of our grand vision and our client vision to make legal advice accessible for all small to medium-sized businesses around the world. And that's where we're going international with it. So I'm glad to hear that feedback. That's great.
Very, very cool. So I heard you drop a little bit of a line about the next book. So maybe later in 2018, we'll get you back to talk about that one. I better have a bit of a read first. So let me know when that's hitting the shops. But before, what's the time frame on the new book?
I'm currently in negotiations with a couple of publishers. I did self-publish the first one. If I can get the right deal, I will go with a publisher. Otherwise, I'll do it myself. So hopefully I'll know by the end of January. This time of year, they're very busy. Hopefully I'll know in the next month or so where we're going to go.
Oh, brilliant. Well done. Alrighty, I'm mindful of the time and that the day is passing us by here. Any last sort of just pearls of wisdom for allied health business owners? Anything that you might have missed or anything that you want to kind of emphasize for us?
I think probably not that I've missed. What I want to emphasize, and we've said it quite a few times, both of us, that you don't know what you don't know.
Yeah.
Get advice and make sure that you're getting advice from all of your advisors, and also that you understand it, and don't be afraid to ask questions. It might feel like you're silly. It might feel like you're stupid, but you're not. Yeah, there are many, many different ways and things to understand, and no one person can do it all. You can't just rely upon your advisors to do everything for you. You have to understand things. So make sure that you ask questions and that you get the advice, because the people that do run the most successful businesses I've seen, and the people who don't end up blaming everyone else when their business fails.
Touché. I completely, completely agree. And I would add to that that it's not about the size of your business. Some of the best businesses I work with are solopreneurs, and they've invested in themselves and they've got this information and they're fluent in it and they can explain it and describe it. And it doesn't matter. You don't have to be learning this stuff just because you're bringing in team and building and scaling and all the rest of it. It's just as relevant to the solo guys, I think.
Very true. Very true.
All righty. Thank you, thank you, thank you. We're going to be listening to you present live at the Pediatric Private Practice Virtual Conference in February. So we'll get, lucky us, we get to hear your thoughts on some other topics as well. So thank you, Jeremy. For those listening, we'll have the links to his website and the book, and there might even be two books in there that we can link to when this hits the airwaves. So big thank you.
Thank you very much for having me, and I'm looking forward to presenting at your conference.
All righty, see you. Have a good one.
Thank you.
Thank you for investing your time right through to the end of this episode of Private Practice Secrets. If you're running a private practice and keen for more business confidence and management know-how, head on over to our website, nacre.com.au. I'll spell it, nacre.com.au. Over there, you'll find all sorts of business resources and inspiration, blogs, forms, web events, freebies, our virtual conference information, workshops, and more. And don't be shy. Take advantage of the free power call and book yourself into my diary for the chance to have a business chat and to pick my brains. I'm Cathy Love, Allied Health Business Coach, wishing you and your business a brilliant day.